This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling.
Hi, this is Javon, your Blinds.com design consultant.
Oh, wow, a real person.
Yep, I'm here to help with everything from selecting the perfect window treatments to...
Well, I've got a complicated project.
No problem. I can even help schedule a professional measure and install. We can also send you samples fast and free.
I just might have to do more.
Whatever you need.
So the first room we're looking at is for...
Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 40% site-wide. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions apply.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi everyone, Brian Kilmeade here. Like the guy with the deep voice says, it's going to be an exciting show. So glad you're with us here on this Thursday. 1-866-408-7669. Number to call to be part of the show this hour. We have a great guest, Selena Zito. She's got a fantastic book out, exclusive information about Butler. It's called Butler, The Untold Story of the Near Assassination of Trump and the Fight for America's Heartland. I mean, she chronicles, and you see some excerpts in the New York Post and other outlets, where and the Washington Post, where she talks about she was supposed to go to Butler and do an interview. It was going to be after the event. And Donald Trump said, well, before the event, would you come see me? So she's there with her daughter, son-in-law, and he was a photographer, and he goes, no, he doesn't want to do the interview now. He just wants to say hello. And then by the time they say hello and they have their pleasantries, he goes, no, I'll do it back at Bedminster, but I want to say hello and introduce you to everybody. And he does that. And he thought, what a great guy. I haven't talked to him in 2 years. It's been great. It's going to be a great interview. And then she realized he's walking right on stage. I might as well stay in the backdrop. So she got the bird's eye view of the near death of Donald Trump. We'll talk about that. But for now, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
It's clear to us as House Democrats, it's clear to us as members of the New York City delegation, that the problem is Donald Trump and House Republicans who have launched this unprecedented assault on the American way of life.
Right. Hakeem Jeffries, don't think so. Let's talk about the Democratic the primary winner, Zohran Mamdani, a major Democratic headache as the Dem nominee for mayor. Reinforces his radical views, his past comments worse than even his present ones, and his disciples begging are now looking to target other Democrats, David Hogg style, like Hakeem Jeffries.
Number two.
I know they made the request. We're going to have to take a look at it. Very expensive. It's a shame that we have to spend so much money on a war that would have never happened if I were president.
Ukraine and Gaza coming to a head as Trump seems about to dump Putin and use weapons in Congress to smash back at Ukraine after Ukraine attacks, while Hamas and IDF close in on a 60-day ceasefire and a hostage for prisoners swap. We'll talk about that.
Number one.
We are normalizing a government agency disappearing people. We are normalizing, we're talking about it like it's no big deal that they are kidnapping people and transporting them to concentration camps, both domestic and foreign.
What is wrong with these people? That's Tiffany Cross of CNN. And yes, she has a job. ICE under attack from within. That's law enforcement, ladies and gentlemen. Don't get confused. That's law enforcement. Yes, blue American cities, radical mayors, and left-wing whack jobs, and all Democrats can say is drop the mask as ICE is under attack. We examine that. When I talk about under attack, literally under attack, organized attacks in Texas. Well, when you see what's happening at the park in Los Angeles, you see these guys come running out and the mayor come running out there and saying, we got to stop MacArthur Park from being invaded. Invaded, really, by law enforcement? MacArthur Park, what's that like? MacArthur Park, oh yeah, the kids are in camp. Maybe there are some kids in camp. You know what mostly MacArthur Park is? A staging area for human trafficking, for drug laundering, for illegal immigrants to get jobs and go in. They don't belong here with backgrounds. So what they got to do, because they have a mayor who's a sanctuary city mayor who hates ICE and law enforcement, is a radical who loves Fidel Castro and goes to Ghana when her city is under siege with fires. A year ago, 2 days ago, Mayor Bass goes in and tries to take them on. This is what he's up against. Look what's happening in Chicago. And look what's happening with this Mamdani saying that we're going to get rid of all ICE cooperation, that Eric Adams has finally broken through. I mean, we weren't crazy in America and once said, we got to defund the police. We never thought on this show, on Fox News, most sober Americans, defund the police was probably the stupidest idea I've ever heard. Now, Democrats go, no, it wasn't me. Biden goes, it wasn't me. But we remember exactly who it was. It was the entire squad. And it was most of the Democrats who thought police were the problem. It's the same thing with ICE. Don't let anyone tell you it's different. When you say, let's stop ICE, you're saying stop law enforcement. And when you're saying stop law enforcement from working with other law enforcement, you're hurting the country. That's in my view. This has gotten totally out of control. Here's what Trump was asked yesterday by Peter Ducey. Cut one.
Two Democratic senators now, Cory Booker and Alex Padilla, have a new bill out. They want to require CBP and ICE officers to have legible IDs. And they don't want CBP or ICE officers covering their faces. Would you ever sign that?
Well, they wouldn't be saying that if they didn't hate our country. And they obviously do. I'm surprised that they would do it. Knowing a little bit about them, I don't know them well. But these officers are doing a tremendous job. They're great patriots. If you expose them because of, you know, statements like have been made by Democrats and others on the left, usually, mostly, I think probably exclusively, you put them in great danger, tremendous danger.
So what they want to do is stop ICE from being effective. They want to defund them. And if Democrats win ever, they will defund them. Joe Biden defunded these guys. He demoralized them, told them they were doing a bad job. But now Border Patrol and ICE working together to rid our country of the 8 to 12 million that Joe Biden let in, that even John Kerry, according to in an interview with the BBC, said the Democrats did a terrible job. They should have enforced the border. At one point, I told Joe Biden, say, we are not a country if you don't enforce your border. That's a Republican line that should be an American line. But now Democrats say, OK, we kind of blew it in the border. So how do we recover from that? Instead of admitting it, how about we go down on the people that want to round up the illegals that got in here, many of which are hardened criminals, have no business here. Some have just came in here illegally. Some are up to no good. Some are gangsters. They're going to be tracked down. It's going to cost a lot of money, a lot of time. And guess what? We got it. We have the money now in the big, beautiful bill. So they're not going anywhere. And I just hope nobody, instead of backing off if you're an ICE agent and listening to me, I hope you go and recruit other people to do what you're doing, because we absolutely need you out there. And what he's referring to is this big push for Democrats to come out and make these ICE guys take their masks off. One of the reasons they don't want to take their masks off, because they're going after their houses, docs, and going after them in social media, and they're trying to go after their families. So why would you take your mask off? If you want to know, should they be clearly labeled? Yeah, I want ICE clearly labeled. And guess what? They're clearly labeled. They got their names. They got their badges on. It's clearly on their uniform. It's clearly on their Kevlar. There is no controversy there. And if you want to know why I believe that they're still, through the mask, able to do some facial technology, they got this NYU professor. This Professor McDonald, he was an adjunct at NYU. He did interactive telecommunications. Well, he came up with an app that allowed you to be able to shoot, be able to tape someone's eyes, and be able to go through LinkedIn and see if they have any type of profile, find out exactly where they live and how to get in touch with them. So if you think that's made up, you are dreaming. And if you think that Cory Booker and Padilla, if they actually think that this is a roadway to taking back the Senate, the House, and in 28 the White House, you are crazy. Here's Todd Lyons, cut three.
ICE will still do its mission no matter what. You saw that in Los Angeles, right? We didn't back down when we had no support. When Karen Bass told us to get out of LA, we didn't back down. And they're out there still doing great work. We will continue to do that. What a lot of these mayors don't realize is their own police departments reach out to ICE through back channels because they don't want these violent criminal offenders on the streets. Those brave men and women in uniform in the local police departments deal with these same repeat offenders again and again that get released that could be turned over to ICE. So most local law enforcement want to work with us. But if the mayors don't want to work with us, then that's fine. We will continue to do our mission.
So, and they're suing. Los Angeles is suing ICE to get them out. There's going to be a hearing today. They are joined some of these individual cases of illegal immigrants who are suing to be able to stay here. They could be at a U.S. District Court in front of a Obama-appointed judge. They're going to be joined by some other humanitarian immigration groups. They're for illegal immigrants, not for Americans. Attorneys general from the following states have also joined to sue against ICE and the federal government. An amicus brief supporting the plaintiffs, Arizona, California, Colorado, Connecticut, Hawaii, Illinois, Maine, Massachusetts, and Maryland. They want ICE out. You can't. You can't have them out. They're not going to be out. So you'll just work their way up the ladder again. You're going to lose again. If you want to know the malign nature of what we're dealing with, listen to an example of Tiffany Cross, Cut 5.
We are normalizing a government agency disappearing people. We are normalizing. We're talking about it like it's no big deal that they are kidnapping people and transporting them to concentration camps, both domestic and foreign.
Yeah, concentration camps. They're putting them into detainment centers and sending them out. They got rid of the temporary protective status and sending them out. People, there's going to be a situation where the president is going to be taking on some right wing of his party by working with his agricultural secretary, meatpacking perhaps, and hospitality, and saying, you've been here over 10 years. If a boss will vouch for you, you perhaps and been a solid worker and you'll get a sponsor, you're not going to get citizenship. You might get a extended work visa to continue doing what you're doing. And why does that make sense? Now, some Republicans are incensed on this. I think there's got to be a practical side to all policy. This is ideally what we want. Now let's deal with what we can do. Now what happens is, if they did a survey in 2022 of all farm workers, 42% of all farm workers were undocumented. I should never say that word. Illegal immigrants without proper paperwork. Don't belong here. No Social Security number. But what they do is they probably have kids, which means, because birthright citizenship is still a thing, the kids are Americans. So they have kids here. They're working in the community. They've been great, almost part of a lot of these farmers' families. And I think there's going to be a situation where they have an opportunity to stay. But I just don't think that Tom Homan said, I'm not getting ahead of the president. What the president says is going to go. I got it. It's interesting. And I'll have Charlie Kirk on Sunday on One Nation. And Charlie Kirk is dead set against this. I'm not. And I think we should talk about it. I want to get that out. But about what's happening right now, I think it's just clear. Do not get caught up. Whatever channel you listen to, whatever channel you watch, whatever podcast you take in, just keep in mind. Law enforcement trying to get illegal immigrants out of the country, the worst first. If the worst are hanging out with other people, they get scooped up as well. If you don't produce documentation, if you're driving without a license, you can get fined. You could get your car taken away. Pull that car over, you're done. So if you're here illegally, temporary protective status has been lifted in Venezuela, Haiti, and a few other countries. I think it's Honduras and Nicaragua because they're communist, horrible leaders. We can't make special provisions. We want immigrants, want work visas. We don't want that. Okay. Couple more things just before we take a break. I want to give a chance for some calls. 1-866-408-7669. Had a few days off, and I also want to also give you an understanding. The big beautiful bill passed since we spoke, and it happened on July 4th, and everyone was too busy to understand what that's going to be. And I want to talk about Ukraine, because the president has totally come around to my line of thinking and maybe yours. Vladimir Putin can't be trusted. He is the bad guy in the region. Zelensky is less than perfect, but man, have they fought valiantly. And Joe Biden slow walk weapons and really extended the pain, but they fought above their weight. They just want defensive weapons. And the president bucked his team and said, we're giving it to him. He is ticked off at Putin. Cut 10.
For Putin, I said, you go in to Ukraine, there's a bomb out of Moscow. I'm telling you, I have no trust. So he goes like, I don't believe you. I said, he said, no way. And I said, way. And then he goes like, I don't believe you. But the truth is, he believed me 10%.
Okay. Now, do I think the president would have bombed Moscow? No. But do I think that they thought the president was crazy enough to bomb Moscow? Yeah. And did he think they were going to go in? No. You probably would have said, as soon as they said, well enough troops, because you got to knock this off, and we would have made some type of adjustment. Said this president, said, oh, what about a small incursion, the past president? And then he demanded for Vladimir Putin to be overthrown, which was great. Meanwhile, China wants this whole war to continue because they want us distracted over there. And the president realizes that. At the same time, he's saying, buy the weapons, use them from Europe. Europe, this is your war. But it's certain things that only America can do. And I think the president understands that better than anybody. He was trying to do is, as crazy as Putin has been, he's saying it does no good to isolate this guy. What has it done isolating him? If I go out there, I deal with him like I dealt with him when he was in business in my first term, and the Russia investigation and the hoax really hurt relations beyond anyone's imagination. Russia thought they had a big win. In the end, they lost, and so did the U.S. lose because of what John Brennan and James Comey did, and led by Hillary Clinton's dossier and everything like that. Think about it. No one ever talks about what it did to relations. They blame Vladimir Putin for everything. He put like a few million dollars in Facebook ads, or his surrogates did. It didn't affect the election. They asked him, who do you want to win? He said, Trump. That didn't affect the election. But I don't want to talk about 2016. But the president opened up his door. This guy's not the same guy. But I'm going to see if I can just walk him down, end this fighting, and I'll tell him. I'll use the carrot of trade and somewhat normalization to start fresh and get your economy going again. And you can just, I'll take the heat. And let them say that I love Vladimir Putin.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
Putin and I have special arrangements. I don't care. I'm one term and I'm done. So the president gave multiple opportunities and met six separate long phone calls. And he came out and he told us exactly what he thought. Really disappointed with this guy. Made no progress. And now Senator Lindsey Graham's sanctions that have got 85 votes in the Senate. The president, he says, I'm not going to give it to the president unless he wants to sign it. I'm not going to pressure him to do anything. And now, according to John Thune, the president is said they're moving quickly on a sanctions package that will put pressure on Russia. The other thing they're going to do is they're going to debate on what to do with this frozen $300 billion. How great would it be to take his $300 billion, give it to Ukraine to buy weapons to blow them out of their country? He thinks he can destroy Ukraine. I don't think he can, especially if we're going to back him. I'm Brian Kilmeade. Next, your calls, 1-866-408-7669. This is The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. Just bottom of the hour, Selena Zito is going to be with us. She has a book out 2 days ago. It's doing fantastic. It's called Butler, The Untold Story, Near Assassination of Donald Trump and the Fight for America's Heartland. We also have a special coming up. It's on Fox Nation on it, so it's going to be great. Also, keep in mind, too, we're getting closer and closer to Dallas. It's going to be the 23rd of August. VIPs have hit an all-time high. We've been doing this 3 years. We've never had this many VIPs. We're coming up almost a third of the tickets sold are VIPs. That's the pregame show. That's the when I have a chance to talk to you, ask questions, and everyone gets a special item. We haven't decided. Sometimes we rotate that through. So go to BrianKilmeade.com. August 23rd, we're going to be in Dallas, Texas. And in September 27th in Richmond, Virginia, History, Liberty, and Laughs. As fascinating as I am, I don't just get up there and talk. Will Cain's going to be there. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West is going to be with us too. Other special guests, Lawrence Jones on vacation, but he's changing things around for us. So it's going to be an exciting show. Hopefully go to BrianKilmeade.com and I can see you in person. When we come back, Selena Zito, you listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show, and I'm glad you are. And keep in mind too, we're not just discussing what's happening the 1 year since the assassination. There is so much going on in the Republican side. Why are they mad at President Trump? I will let you know what they're saying about Pam Bondi. To me, it doesn't make much sense. It's about Jeffrey Epstein. But I want to get your take. Do you think the investigation is yet to be done, or did they just not find anything in the conspiracy?
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Shooter's one of those people that I began to monitor. I've seen him going in and out of eyesight, looking up and paying close attention to where our sniper units were located within that building.
Crooks was spotted on the westernmost window facing south. The Beaver County sniper asked me to come speak with him, and when I went over there, he'd showed me he'd taken two photographs of Crooks. He was suspicious. He kept looking up at the window I was posted at. And as he kept looking up at the window I was posted at, he walked in up against the building to the point where I couldn't see him, almost like he was hiding.
Just didn't really seem like he gave any cares about actually being at a presidential rally.
So that is just a small portion of the special about the 1 year since the assassination attempt on Donald Trump that came so close. The more you analyze it, you realize how close it came to taking his life right then, right there. I mean, keep in mind, no running mate. It would have been curtains for the Republican Party. It would have been a walk for Joe Biden or Kamala Harris to the presidency. And we would have had a tragedy that we still haven't fully unwound. But the person closest to telling us who knows what happened that day is with us now. It's Selena Zito, nationally syndicated columnist, good friend of the show. Her book, Butler, The Untold Story of the Near Assassination of Donald Trump and the Fight for America's Heartland, is now out. Selena, your thoughts first about what you just heard about now that we know the details. You were behind the scenes after speaking to the president before the event. But now the more you hear about this gunman moving around on the roof and how he was there earlier and how he got up and how people spotted him, what are your thoughts as you're hearing that?
Well, you know, it reminds me, Brian, in the weeks and months after 9/11, and how we talked about how these interagencies, these agencies that are charged to protect us and protect the country and protect, you know, and have intelligence, didn't communicate with each other, right? That was the genesis behind Homeland Security being created. And that same failure happened that day. There was no communication with local law enforcement. And that is so egregious because these are the men and women who know that territory. This is their backyard. This is where they live. And they have no ability to communicate with the federal agencies that are there supposed to be protecting the president.
So there's so many elements to this. There's Corey Compentori and his death as he jumped on his family and saved their lives but lost his. Big fan of the president, was in the wrong place at the wrong time. President moved his head just at the right time. But why don't you tell people, you were supposed to interview the president, first time in a few years, and it was going to be back at Bedminster, but you wanted to go see the event at Butler, and you were going to fly back with him, right?
Right. So the morning started out, I was supposed to interview him for 5 minutes before the event. Then it changed to 5 minutes after the event. Then it went, do you want to go to Bedminster? And I'm like, of course. And then right before he goes on stage, they grab me and say, it's go time. I thought I was going to interview him then, right? I thought they changed their mind again, which is how these things roll. But instead, he wanted to say hi to me. And I asked about my grandchildren. Yeah. And he said he's looking forward to the interview. At that moment, we're 2 minutes before he goes out. So I'm placed along with my daughter in the buffer. And that's the well that's around the stage. That's why I end up so close to him when it happens. And that's why the photo, the cover of the book taken by my daughter is because we're following him out. The rally had barely, just got started. I mean, there had to be at least 50,000 people there. It was massive. And he does two things simultaneously that he never does. If you've ever gone to a Trump rally, you know that relationship between him and the people attending is very transactional. He never turns his head away from them. He never has anything out on stage to distract people from him. Yet in several split seconds, a chart comes down. I remember turning to my daughter and says, what is he, Ross Perot now? Because there's a chart down. And then he turns his head away. He never turns his head away. And that's when the first four shots went out over my head.
And so did you ever feel you're in danger? Because I know an excerpt from your book, I know you said that your son-in-law dove on your daughter and then pushed you to the ground.
His campaign press advance man, Michel Picard, eventually, after the 7-4 shot or the last four shots rang out, took me to the ground, and because I didn't get down. You know, these things do. You know, people say tragic events tend to go in slow motion.
Yeah.
For me, that was also the case. I see him grab his ear. I see the blood streak across his face. I see him take himself down. That was my first indication that maybe he's okay, or at least he's not as gravely wounded as I thought he might be because of the blood. And then at the same time that the next round of shots go off, he is surrounded by a sea of Secret Service. And I see them, you know, put a protective stance around him. In my mind, I'm thinking, okay, I have a gift, and I have purpose. I'm a witness to history. I need to remember everything that is happening around me because I think it's very, very important. I didn't know I was going to write a book in that moment, but I knew that I was chronicling history. So I didn't think about myself, and I'm not trying to come across as selfless. I just knew that I had purpose and I had a job in that moment. So I continued working. My recorder was on. I heard everything that he talked about with the Secret Service, including his insistence to put his shoes on, which was almost like, in the moment, it was almost like comic relief, right? Like, my God, he's talking about his shoes.
But did you hear that? Did you hear that?
Oh, yeah. That was that close. And the crowd at that point, as they're lifting, as the Secret Service is, you know, surrounding him as he lifts himself up, they start saying USA. And I can see him mouth it. And then they go to take him off the stage. And he's like, no, wait. And he does the fight. And the next morning, when he calls me the first thing the next morning.
What time?
And he says, I don't remember even sleeping. Maybe like 7 in the morning,
and
something
where are
like
you?
That. I was at home.
Okay.
And I live in Western Pennsylvania. My family is from Butler. Came to Butler in 1740s, 1750s. One of the founding families of Butler.
That's an interesting twist.
Yeah. And he calls me, and the first thing he says, Brian, is, Selena, this is President Trump. Like, I don't know that, right? And then he says, are you okay? Is your daughter and son-in-law okay? He says them by name, too. And then he says, I am really sorry we didn't get to do that interview. And I did something that my parents are not going to be proud of. I said, are you bleeping kidding me, sir? You were just shot. I'm not worried about an interview. He would go on to call me. It was a total of 7 times that day. We had
really?
Some powerful.
So he said, let's do it over the phone? Is that what you mean? Let's do this interview over the phone?
No, he was just talking. He just wanted to talk. And had I been a different reporter, I probably would have pressed him. But I felt like he needed to talk. And I felt like he needed space to think about things. So we talked about God. He questioned himself. He's saying it to me, but I know he's talking about himself, right? He goes, why did I do that, Selena? Why did I turn my head? Why did I have that chart go down? And then he comes to the conclusion several times that it was the hand of God. And then he comes to the conclusion that he was spared because he has been given a higher purpose than to just be a candidate for president, to be the best thing that he could possibly be for the country. And it's a really just an amazing and emotional experience the reader will go through.
Here, but, I want you to hear also what Susie Wiles' take was. She was also there. Was she near you?
No, she was in the back. Susie was in the back like behind the stage.
Gotcha.
And there's monitors back there. They eventually took me back there, but there's monitors there, and they're watching, and they're watching everything that happens.
Yeah, I've seen behind the scenes. They're very efficient. Here's Susie Wiles talking to Miranda Devine. Cut 29.
The way the rally itself unfolded, the chart he had them put up on the screens, on the big LED boards, came, it was always the last chart in the rotation. And it was always on the other side. So to have him ask for that chart 8 minutes in and to have it come on the side that is opposite caused him, well, it's this way, caused him look in a different direction and lift his head just a little because it was higher. And that just doesn't happen because it happened.
Yes.
It happened because I believe God wanted him to live.
So you're all under the same impression.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what was really moving, Brian? And what I think is important about the rest of the book, because the book goes then through the rest of the campaign and what was really happening on the ground. And him and I talking dozens of times between July and November. I ask him one question for a story. I said, can I just ask you one question? I'm really curious about this. He goes, sure. And I wrote that. I wrote it the next day. Why did you say fight, fight, fight? He said, well, Selena, and I'm paraphrasing here. He's like, I wasn't Donald Trump in that moment. I represented the presidency of the United States. I represented everything that is supposed to, when you think about America, when you think about grit, exceptionalism, never backing down, keep getting up when you get kicked down. I knew that I had to project that because that was a responsibility for me as president. I'm not Donald Trump. I'm representing everything that is good and great about our country. And I knew had I not done that, there might have been panic in that farm field, and there wasn't. He said that there might be panic in the streets and people watching it on television, and there wasn't. I needed people to know that we go on and we will always go on no matter what comes at us.
That's what he told you that day, the next day.
Yeah. And so, we talked about it again a couple weeks ago.
So does he like the book?
Yeah, he likes the book a lot.
Okay, great.
He has endorsed the book. He signed the book. He loved it. And he thought I did a really, really great job.
And you did. The other thing is three people were hit. One did not survive. Corey Compitore.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's – is it Compitore or Compitore?
Compitore.
You know? Compitore. Okay. So his wife's on the special, and she is obviously extremely upset. And if you look at this guy's background, he looks like just an extraordinary American. So it like really characterizes so many of the people that followed President Trump. Alexis McAdams also there. I want you to hear this exchange. Cut 27.
If you had the chance to sit down with the Secret Service, what would you ask them?
I want to know what the hell they were thinking that day. Where were they? Why didn't they come pick up the radios? Why weren't they in communication with all those other people? Why weren't they paying attention? Why did they think that that roof didn't need covered? I can see it. You can see it from the farm show. Why would they let the president come out? Why weren't they watching? We were all sitting ducks that day. Our blood is all over their hands. I'm angry. I lost the love of my life. My kids lost their father. They screwed up.
Man, that says it all.
Yeah. That's really rough. I have a piece in the Washington Post today that I interviewed both President Trump and Helen. You know, Helen and Corey, they first met in kindergarten. They were boyfriend and girlfriend in middle school. These are people that were intertwined almost their entire life. And the emotion that she feels is very reflective in the interview I do with Trump. This, he carries Corey with him all the time, all the time. It's very difficult for him to talk about. And those lives are forever intertwined.
And do they feel like the president cares about them?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In the interview she does with me, her affection for President Trump is unwavering. And to this day, she fears about his life because of that incompetency in the protective services. And you know, President Trump has said this, and so has Helen. They don't. It's not about the men and women that were there that day. It's about the decisions made from D.C., far from Farmfield and Butler. And it was those moments, Brian, that changed America a lot that day in a way I don't think people really have been able to understand or soak in.
Selena, congratulations. We're going to talk about this again, but I want everyone to know to pick up the book now and get it. I think everyone thinks they know the story, but they don't. They got to pick up your book, Butler, The Untold Story, The Near Assassination of Donald Trump and the Fight for America's Heartland. It's all 1 year Sunday. So, and there's also a special on Fox Nation. Selena, congratulations, and we'll have you back.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you very much.
Yeah, great job. Back in a moment. We'll try to squeeze in some calls. 1-866-408-7669.
Learning something new every day on The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, I'm Trey Gowdy, host of the Trey Gowdy Podcast. I hope you will join me every Tuesday and Thursday as we navigate life together and hopefully find ourselves a little bit better on the other side.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
A lot of people on the right say, well, it's New York, they deserve it, they're all on the left, they should suffer. But if this guy wins, he gets a $100 billion budget to use towards his cronies. And we've all seen, thanks to President Trump and his work, what they do when they use these budgets. They give them to their friends to promote radical activism. They fund terrible things. This is very dangerous stuff for somebody this extreme, and it's our job to speak up against it. And it's crazy. Here in Silicon Valley, some of my friends and I speaking up against him were being criticized for speaking against him. And meanwhile, he's like this radical anti-white communist. It's crazy.
He is anti-white. He was anti-white in, and he's white, I guess. He's in college at that ridiculous school he went to. And now he writes down he's African-American because he's a white guy from Uganda. I guess technically Jesse Jackson should be faulted because he wanted no longer for black people to be called black. He wanted them to be called African-Americans. So I guess technically born in Uganda, maybe he is, but that's not being sincere on your application. And Mamdani is who, that's Joe Lonsdale. Joe Lonsdale is a self-made multi-billionaire who's a founder of Palantir, a big Trump supporter. But he's concerned about Zohran Mamdani becoming the socialist communist mayor of New York City. Forget about political fortunes. This guy gets more money from the federal government in New York City than anything else. He will destroy the state. Upstate New York dies on the vine. Long Island gets starved. And New York City falls apart.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
All right, I'm Brian Kilmeade. Thanks so much for listening. It's going to be a big hour. As you know, Fox News Studios in Midtown New York City. Josh Krasauer is standing by, Fox News Radio's political analyst, editor-in-chief of the Jewish Insider, and the great Mark Thiessen, Washington Post columnist, former speechwriter for Bush. He is also a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, so AEI. He's going to be with us shortly. He's got a great column out today as well. And today, Marco Rubio met with Sergey Lavrov. I don't know what came out of this meeting, the foreign minister of Russia, but we have a totally different stance when it comes to Ukraine. And now I think Secretary of State Marco Rubio, I'm sure, would welcome the opportunity to begin to get more aggressive with him. Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
It's clear to us as House Democrats, it's clear to us as members of the New York city delegation, that the problem is Donald Trump and House Republicans who have launched this unprecedented assault on the American way of life.
Yes, exactly, Akeem Jeffries. What is he doing? I'm talking about Zohran Mamdani, a major Democratic headache, as the Dem nominee for mayor of New York City reinforces his radical views. His past comments are actually worse than his present, which is hard to believe. And his disciples are now beginning to target other Democratic leaders. David Hogg style. Good luck, guys.
Number two.
I know they made the request. We're going to have to take a look at it. It's very expensive. It's a shame that we have to spend so much money on a war that would have never happened if I were president.
Ukraine and Gaza coming to a head as Trump seems about to dump Putin and use weapons and earmark towards them, defensive weapons, especially some Patriots. And Congress is ready to step up and smash back with some Ukrainian sanctions while Hamas and the IDF close in on a 60-day ceasefire and hostage for prisoners swap this weekend.
Number one.
We are normalizing a government agency disappearing people. We are normalizing. We're talking about it like it's no big deal that they are kidnapping people and transporting them to concentration camps, both domestic and foreign.
Yep, Tiffany Cross of CNN. She's a genius. ICE under attack from within. Yes, blue American cities, radical Democratic mayors, and left-wing whack jobs. All Dems can say is drop the mask and push back on ICE and sue them to get him out of our city. That is the same thing as defund the police. They are police officers. That is law enforcement. And remember, Democrats said, what were we doing? What were we thinking? Defund the police? Joe Biden says, I never said that. And then it was just the squad that said that. Everyone said, oh, then in comes Mamdani, who says, yeah, I want social workers. I don't really want as many cops. And I want to reimagine police. And then we have the attack of ICE. Attack on ICE from Mayor Bass. Attack on ICE by the mayor of Chicago. Attack on ICE from Senator Cory Booker and Padilla, who want to take the masks off, not off Antifa, the Columbia protests, the anti-Semitic rages, where all these idiots wear the hospital masks to cover their face. They want them off our law enforcement. Josh Krasauer joins us now. Josh, for the life of me, I understand parties are different, but why do they think, and maybe I'm wrong, why do they think attacking ICE is a pathway to taking back the House?
Well, they didn't until recently. I think Democrats were trying to moderate their views and their rhetoric on immigration. Some of the high-profile cases in recent months, Maryland Man, Garcia, and other high-profile examples that they felt were kind of an examples of overly aggressive tactics by ICE, certainly captured the left attention, and that sort of changed the zeitgeist within the Democratic Party. But it's a real political problem for them. And if the Mamdani model becomes the template for your average Democrat running for Congress or running for statewide office, that's going to be a big problem. Democrats, that has been the one issue going back years on them trying to take back the energy from the base and moderating their message on immigration and border security in a way that can appeal to a broader array of voters. They've been badly out of touch on the issue. And look, these performative stunts too, you know, Brad Lander in the mayor's race trying to get arrested by chaining himself or hanging on to a person who was about to be deported, or you see this with Karen Bass, you know, that is not the way to win hearts and minds. I think there may be a middle ground on this issue, but the Democrats seem to always play to the left and the base, and that's always put them out of touch with your average American.
I mean, you have them basically saying that you saw Mayor Bass get out of her car the day that to signify the one year anniversary since she was in Ghana when her city was overwhelmed with fire and still not recovered. 5%, only 5% of the permits have been green lighted to rebuild almost all of Southern California. It's crazy, but she wants to look like a tough woman going after ICE in MacArthur Park, which I'm seeing video of MacArthur Park. It's a drug den, and it's a place of human trafficking of illegal immigrants. That's why ICE is there. So I'm just wondering what resonates with the American people, and they must be seeing some type of pie chart that says that this is where they should be, because they're now suing ICE to get them out of their city.
Well, I don't know if that's based on their polling on where the American people are. I think it's where their base is. And they look at Chuck Schumer when he, on a separate issue, when he didn't shut down the government after the debate over the budget. He got nailed by a lot of Democratic voters that were dissatisfied that he's not fighting enough. That is where the activist left is coming from. And they are We've known this since the 2024 election. They have held even more moderate Democratic politicians hostage to take radical or very out of the mainstream positions on a whole slew of cultural issues, including immigration, not even a cultural issue necessarily, but immigration, trans issues, anti-Semitism. These are issues that they're taking like a 10%, 20% side on.
I know.
But that's where the money is. That's where the donors are. And that's where the most vocal parts of their party are. So they've been finding it really, really difficult to extricate themselves from that donor base.
But here's the danger. So, you have positions. Okay. You don't like the big, beautiful bill. All right. You do like it. Okay. I'll debate that. That's okay. But when you say to fund the police, I go, are you kidding? Do you realize what's going to happen to this country? And we'll never say that again. But we are saying it. When you say get rid of ICE, you're basically going after law enforcement again. And this is what Stephen Miller said. And I know when you hear Stephen Miller, just like any partisan, you think, okay, that's what Republicans think. But he's absolutely right, because they are saying there's blood on the hands. They want to see blood in the streets fighting back. Stephen Miller, cut six.
This is rhetoric that is used to justify violence, that is used to justify terrorism, that has directly led to, has directly inspired enormous assaults, a 700% increase in assaults on ICE officers, and of course, recent attempts at murder against ICE officers, including in Texas, where you had a shootout at, in this case, a Border Patrol facility that, again, is inspired by this hateful, odious, villainous rhetoric.
And you got Hamas supporters jumping all over ICE vehicles in wearing Hamas paraphernalia in San Francisco. You saw them surrounding the cars. You saw what happened to them. The officers got surrounded by people in Los Angeles. And then you saw what happened in Texas. I mean, this is beyond real, Josh.
Yeah, I mean, the temperature is heated up, and look, there's a sensible middle on the issue of immigration and border security. And Trump has, at times articulated it pretty clearly himself. But, deport the illegal immigrants. I think people have been here. I think the big sticking point, and if Democrats are a little smarter, they should hone their message a little bit. But, like, I think the big risk for Republicans is that people who have been here for decades and have been business leaders and solid members of the community, they probably shouldn't be on the deportation list. I think that's where Republicans could go a little too far on the politics of the issue. But yeah, the temperature is hot. I mean, and the bases are driving the conversation. Look, I think when it comes to the two sides, the Republicans, if you look at all the polling, have the stronger argument. Republicans won the election in large part because Democrats were perceived as being just willing to take in anyone who wanted to cross the border. And that's unsustainable. We've seen the data, and we've seen the degree of enforcement and success the Trump administration has had changing that tide. But the middle is often lost in the immigration debate. I think people wanted criminals deported. They want people who just came over the border and are not being tracked. They need to be going back to their home countries. I think where Republicans are at risk politically, and Miller may not be the best spokesperson along these lines, is that there's an eagerness to almost support legal people who are here on humanitarian grounds, or even people who have been, there's some people who have been in the country right for quite some time who have protected status that I think the administration has been trying to target as well. I think that may go a little bit above where the political sweet spot is.
So John Kerry was on the BBC, with the BBC, and he said the Democrats allowed the migrant siege of the U.S. border. Quote, the first thing any president should say or anyone in public life is, without a border protected, you don't have a nation. I wish President Biden had been heard more often saying, I'm going to enforce the law. So they understand the border is an issue. They understand that Trump just did what they said was impossible. He totally shut down the border. Now he's got more money to finish the wall, harder, more border patrol. So he did the impossible. Now, Trump is going to find he's get some turbulence from people I really like Charlie Kirk and others, who he's going to say, if you've been here a long time and you have a sponsor from your, let's say, the farm or the meatpacking company or the hospitality agency you're with, and they want to sponsor, you're not going to get citizenship, but maybe you'll get an extended visa. And 42% of agriculture workers are illegal immigrants. So he's looking at this, understanding that these industries need these people, and he's working on something that they stay. Now, Republicans are not going to like that, Josh.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think the two areas where I think Trump gets it, by the way. Trump understands the problem.
I'm with that, by the way. Yeah. I'm with him on that.
Ag and a lot of industries that do rely. I mean, and again, these are like people who are working really thankless jobs and really helping the industries that they've been a major part of. And I also think the people, and then the other category, which I mentioned earlier, is, you know, people who have been here for decades. I mean, this is sort of the debate when we had DACA and the Dreamers. That was the argument going back to the Obama era, where people who have, you know, been either kids of illegal immigrants or people who have been in this country. There was an example in Louisiana where Steve Scalise, an Iranian woman who had been in the country for four decades, was a cherished member of her community in Louisiana. She got detained by ICE, and Steve Scalise and a lot of Republicans intervened because she was a rock solid, like everything you want from an American. And she was basically the fact. I mean, he was basically, you know, there was some complications in her status, but she had basically been living here for many, many years. So, like, those are the when you hear those examples, that's where Democrats feel like they can go on offense. But I think the fundamentals of this issue are clearly in the Republican Party's favor. And I think Trump, really, when he takes the lead on the subject, he can really drive the conversation and the politics in the GOP's direction.
So I want to talk about Gavin Newsom. He goes to South Carolina, has multiple stops, and he seems to have impressed James Clyburn. Cut 25.
As we go around welcoming these candidates who are running for president, let's not forget about school board.
Says he really likes Gavin Newsom's record. Gavin Newsom pretended when he said running for president, he looked around, was like, you can't mean me, and everyone laughed. But you don't go to South Carolina, make six stops in 110-degree humid weather, leave California to do it. Meanwhile, I don't know if they have some unfinished business there. He doesn't seem to want to do that job. But what kind of candidate? He looks the part, but his report card, Josh, is terrible.
Yeah, that is such a good way of putting it, that on paper, like, Newsom looks like, I mean, on paper, in terms of just the bio, the looks, the charisma, Newsom would be at the top of the list. And then you look at the record in California and how much he moved to the left and how much the party moved to the left, and the homelessness issue, the crime issue, the unwillingness to take on the base issue. That's not where the party is. That's not the sweet spot to winning elections. Now, Brian, I could see a scenario in 2028 where the Mamdani wing of the party, the AOC wing of the party, is ascended, and Newsom could end up becoming looking more moderate if the party really does go off the deep end, as they've suggested in the last, or as things have been hinting in the last couple months. So you never know. Like, 2028 is a long time off. But right now, Newsom's brand of progressivism, which he's been distancing him, I mean, he's actually quietly been trying to move back to the center. And you saw the interviews he did with a lot of conservative podcasters and leaders. He's moving away from this position on trans. I mean, he's actually moving to the middle, but California has been the poster child of a lot of the worst aspects of blue state governance. And it's just hard to run away from that. And I think the only way he kind of has an avenue is if the party just goes so far off the deep end that he actually becomes the more electable looking candidate when push comes to shove.
And here's one of the quotes from James Clyburn. He's been a great governor for some time now. Newsom established a record in California that is enviable. Really? He'll just say anything. By the way, Clyburn doesn't have a great track record now. He also said that Kamala Harris, you better get behind her, and Joe Biden is the perfect president. He should not step aside. And then when he finally stepped aside, said did a good thing. Kamala Harris can't get out of her own way. And now it's emerging that she's really got no base even to run for governor. I'm curious to see what's going to happen there. But I want you to hear a little bit what Gavin Newsom said when asked about the trans issue that is now California is being sued for Title IX violations because he's letting trans men play in women's sports and girls' sports. Let's listen.
It's demeaning to talk down to people and to belittle the trans community. And I don't like the way the right wing talks about the trans community. These people just want to survive. Donald Trump makes it very difficult. Extraordinarily difficult, the way he demeans people, he talks down to people, he belittles people, and he intentionally tries to divide people. There's a cruelty. He has, a polluted heart when it comes to so many issues.
Well, so let's beat up on Donald Trump on trans issues, which is an 80-20, so he doesn't like the way they're talked about. What do you think about this? He's going to get this wherever he goes.
Well, he hasn't. Newsom been all over the map on this.
Yes.
I mean, he was obviously a champion of trans. I mean, he was literally on the forefront in California. Then he kind of immediately after the 2024 election results, which underscored how badly Democrats were hurt on that issue, he runs to the right and tries to distance himself, even though he has that record. And now I think he's got backlash from the Democrats, and now he's trying to find out if he can get some kind of middle ground, third way. It goes to show that he kind of has his finger in the wind, and voters could sniff that out. I mean, I think that's one of his weaknesses. He's very charismatic on one hand. On the other hand, he looks a little phony and slick. And then, you know, that's going to show, too, if he decides to run for national office. So, yeah, you know, look,
Gotcha.
I think Democrats need to show more action. There needs to be kind of that sister soldier moment that Bill Clinton was famous for back in the early 90s, where he not only said the things, but walked the walk and showed that he would be willing to reject a lot of the progressive.
Absolutely. I got to take a time, Josh, you're right, but it's called John Fetterman. He's doing the right thing. Josh Krausauer, always interesting. Thanks, Josh. Back in a moment. Bottom of the hour, Mark Thiessen. Of course, you're next. Don't move.
Both sides, all opinions. It's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
What I find it so interesting is to see people rallying against and now for Eric Adams in this race for mayor. You know, Curtis Lee was still trudging along, too. He's not giving up at all. But I saw for the mayor's races such panic because Mamdani right now, according to basically a consolidation of the latest polls, he's up by 10 points to win against Eric Adams, against Cuomo, and against Curtis Sliwa. So they're finding plenty of bad stuff about him. It doesn't seem to be resonating. He's just building, getting a lot of money, and he's building up his list. But now these real estate leaders are starting to have these fundraisers, big-ticket fundraisers, because he wants to freeze all these rents, and people are going to invest here. He's going to raise everybody who is so-called upper class 2%. So now you have this guy Noble Black, this big-time guy. He is also this guy Mark Holliday. They're having big fundraisers, $2,000 a head, in order to stop Mamdani. And most of the money's going for Eric Adams. They think it's the best ticket. I think Cuomo will be a terrible mayor. I would take Adams any day. And Sliwa, ideally.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Well, as the president has indicated, Larry, yes, his patience is wearing thin with Vladimir Putin. When President Trump came into office, he made it very clear that he was interested in as rapid a resolution to this conflict as possible. Vladimir Putin has continued to press the war in Ukraine. And as the president has indicated, he would like to have both sides come to the table. But that has not materialized quite yet.
Well, that has. And Monica Crowley's doing the diplomatic thing. She knows her foreign policy as well as anyone. She has a different position right now. But on with Larry Kudlow yesterday. Joining us now is Mark Thiessen to talk about the latest in Ukraine. And this is unfolding quickly. He's, as you know, he's Fox News contributor. He's a fellow at AEI and he's a Washington Post columnist and has a column about this today, how the president has come on to understand that Vladimir Putin, whoever he thought he was in 2016, is not the same guy today. Mark, welcome back. Your thoughts about where this is at right now. Let's say first from the Ukraine perspective.
Well, first of all, I think Donald Trump was absolutely right to try and talk to Putin and to try and bring this war to an end. And I think, you know, people criticize him for trying to engage our enemies. Ronald Reagan did the same thing. You know, Ronald Reagan had, you know, multiple summits with Mikhail Gorbachev and all the rest of it. But we always forget that there were like three Soviet leaders who died on him before he was able to meet Gorbachev. So yep. He would have never had the breakthroughs with Brezhnev or Andropov or Chernenko that he had with Gorbachev. And so Trump doesn't have his Gorbachev. He's got a Chernenko. He's got an Andropov. He's got a Brezhnev in Vladimir Putin, somebody who doesn't want a deal, who doesn't want peace, who doesn't want to change things. And I think he was right to try it, but I think he's come to the conclusion that Putin wants the war. And so now we got to pivot.
So right now, according to Eurasia's Russia's expert, they said Putin is under the belief that he's got battlefield superiority and it's growing. He says Ukraine's defenses may collapse in the coming months, according to Putin, two people close to the Kremlin. Putin's view is out of the question, him stopping his offensive, quote, he will not sacrifice his goals in Ukraine for the sake of improving relations with Trump. And what he also said, he predicted that Trump would do what he's done now because he knew what he was doing. And that is continuing to fight the war and waste President Trump's time with hour-long conversations where the president concluded at the end, he's BSing me.
Yeah, so Trump's not going to let that happen. Because, I mean, if Putin were to succeed and break through the lines and march on Kyiv on Trump's watch, it would be his Afghanistan.
It would.
You know, it would be a disaster. You know, this right now, this is Biden's disaster that Trump is trying to fix. And but as soon as he lets that happen, the only way that happens is if we don't provide them with the weapons. As long as we keep providing them with weapons, Ukraine with weapons, Russia can't win. So what we have to do now is we need to pivot to a strategy of trying to. The goal is not to help Ukraine gain back all of its territory, though I wish they could have all their territory back. We know that's not going to happen anytime soon. We also don't want to slip back into the Biden strategy, if you could call it that, of slow rolling weapons and, you know, giving them just enough not to lose with no end game in sight. We have to have a clear strategic goal. The strategic goal is the same one that Trump set out from the beginning of his presidency: end the war. Force Vladimir Putin. We know now we're not going to do it with honey. We're not going to sweet talk him into giving up his war aims. So we have to force him. And so the way you force him is with a maximum pressure campaign on the Russian economy and on the battlefield. And the Russian economy is teetering on the brink right now. The only thing that's been keeping them afloat are oil and gas sales. But oil and gas sales have collapsed because Trump has been so successful in bringing down gas prices. The Russian economy they've lost a third of their oil and gas revenue last month. And so if he puts secondary sanctions on Russian oil and gas, if we put a tariff on every country that imports Russian oil and gas, he could do what he did in Iran in the first term, which is literally bring their oil and gas sales down to near zero. And that would absolutely destroy the Russian economy. And then you give Ukraine the weapons on the battlefield that they need to really inflict some serious pain on the Russian forces, and you force Vladimir Putin to the table.
But what do you say to people who think that we are, which was announced or maybe leaked but announced by the Undersecretary Elbridge Colby, that he looked around at our stocks and said, I can't give this to Ukraine. We need them for us.
So number one, there's a Joint Chiefs of Staff report apparently that says that's not true. I think that Bridge is kind of exaggerating some of the shortages. Number two, the way we build up our stockpiles of weapons and our defense industrial base is through foreign military sales. So we sell weapons to Poland. We sell weapons to Romania. We sell weapons to Taiwan. We sell weapons to Saudi Arabia. We sell weapons to Israel. Those weapon sales are what keep our industrial base going, because there's not enough U.S. taxpayer money to keep the assembly line hot to keep producing that. So what we need to do now is transition Ukraine from a military aid recipient. The last of the supplementals is about to run out in August, and transition them to a defense consumer like any other country in the world, and sell them the weapons, which is good for America. It's good for our readiness. And you know, we have some short-term stockpile issues because we had to give a lot of patriots to Israel during the 12-day war, but we can replenish those fairly quickly. And Ukraine can help us replenish them by buying the weapons.
So the Institute of Study of War, which I know you really like, Jack Keane is overseeing that, I think created it. He says China's foreign minister stated that the PRC does not want Russia to lose in Ukraine. This, according to ISW's assessment and intelligence, it says that he says that they want us distracted in Ukraine. They do not want all our focus to be on the Pacific. Now, that is what critics of the Ukraine policy say. We got to focus on China. And I understand that. Is there a way to do both? Is there a way to push back on Russia and still understand that China at any moment could try to take Taiwan?
Well, if we abandoned Ukraine, what would the lesson be to China?
You got it.
That we're not going to come to Taiwan's defense.
Right.
I mean, so here, imagine the world that Donald Trump inherited was one in which the U.S. was considered weak and feckless because of the Afghan withdrawal and which led directly to Putin's invasion of Ukraine, right? So Donald Trump, with Operation Midnight Hammer, restored American deterrence. The Chinese looked at Operation Midnight Hammer and said, holy, you know what? This guy really, no one thought he was going to do it, and he did it, right? And so that now all of a sudden they have to think, well, maybe he will defend Taiwan. Maybe we can't win that. If Trump then I don't think this is a chance that he would, in hell that this would happen, but if Trump were somehow to abandon Ukraine and let Putin win in Ukraine, then the lesson to China is, he's not even willing to give them weapons to fight the war themselves. He's not going to send U.S. forces to defend Taiwan. It would destroy all the deterrence that he just restored with Operation Midnight Hammer. So these things are inextricably linked. Fate of Ukraine, and that's why the Taiwanese believe the fate of Ukraine, the fate of Taiwan depends on the fate of Ukraine.
I hear you, and it looks like Keith Kellogg is encouraged. He told the Washington Post that Trump's agreed to key Ukrainian requests for military aid. They were very specific in the request. They had a very positive phone call also, reporting wide and confirmed that John Thune and Lindsey Graham's sanction policy that's got 85 votes in the Senate will be voted on this month, then July, the next couple of weeks, and will be handed to the president for his approval, only if he wants it. But it looks like he is open to it. Man, that pushes back on a lot of people that said that the president wouldn't do this. And it might tick off the same people that were ticked off when he took out the Iranian nuclear program. What do you think about that, Mark Thiessen?
Well, so two things. One, Donald Trump is not an isolationist. He never was an isolationist. And it's funny how the isolationists today, they don't like being called isolationists, so they've come up with a new name. They call themselves restrainers. Well, who exactly are they restraining?
Yeah.
They're trying to restrain Donald Trump. You know, that's not your job. That's not loyalty. We thought we were going to bring in all these people who were going to faithfully execute Donald Trump's policy into the administration. Well, Donald Trump's policy was, and this is the thing that I love about Donald Trump, is he does what he says. I've never seen a president who's, you know, four presidents said we're going to move the embassy to the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. Only Trump did it. Three previous presidents said we're going to stop the Iranians from getting a nuclear weapon. Only Donald Trump did it. He said, you've got 60 days. And on day 61, the war began. And within 12 days, Operation Midnight Hammer and the Iranian program destroyed. This is a man who does what he says. Well, listen to what he said on Ukraine. It was clear. He said it during the campaign. He said he's going to try and achieve peace. But if Putin says no to peace, then he's going to crush his economy and he's going to arm the hell out of the Ukrainians. So don't be surprised if he does what he said. This is the people like to, I think the isolationist, and by the way, the Reagan Institute poll, everybody should look. I wrote a column on this with all the findings. MAGA Republicans are less isolationist and more hawkish than establishment Republicans. The MAGA movement is not isolationist. Donald Trump is not isolationist. There's a small handful of Republican isolationists who have grafted themselves onto the MAGA movement like leeches and are trying to ride it into power and coerce Trump into following their policies. And he's not listening to them because he doesn't – nobody pushes Donald Trump around. But these people are not MAGA.
I want to bring
you
over –
what MAGA is.
I want to bring you over to Iran, if I can.
And
there is a report now that an unspecified Arab official told Middle East Eye that the PRC, China, has sent surface-to-air missile batteries to Iran within the last 2 weeks to replenish Iran's degraded air defense, further suggesting Iran is turning to China over Russia for help. A side note, French intelligence assessed that Iran's nuclear program is seriously damaged and its weaponization timeline is extremely delayed. That backs up other reports. That's what they're getting. So your thoughts about what we should do as Iran tries to reestablish itself?
Yeah. So here's the beauty of what Donald Trump did and what Israel did in the 12-day war. So remember the Powell Doctrine, which was like, you know, Pottery Barn rule. If you break it, you own it, right? So you go and you strike a country, you own what comes next. And what Donald Trump basically, his innovation was, no, you can just break it. And you can break it over and over and over again. So the taboo of striking Iran is gone. What everyone was told, the Israelis, the hesitation in Israel for striking Iran was, well, they've promised they will send 1,000 ballistic missiles at us all at once, and our air defenses can't handle that, and that means there's going to be a second Holocaust. It'll be worse than October 7th because thousands and thousands of Israelis
will
die.
That was said recently.
And that was what everyone estimated. Institute for the Study of War, they were never able to muster more than 40 ballistic missiles at a time. The whole taboo has been broken. What that means is Israel can strike Iran at will, anytime they want. So you want to go try and rebuild your air defenses? Israel can take them out. And I think we just got to keep playing whack-a-mole. It's like, look, the war is over. You just stay down, and if you try and get up, we're going to knock you down again. And we're going to do it over and over. You want to reconstitute your nuclear program? We took it out once. We'll take it out again. You're never going to be able to do it. So stop. Right. You know, there's no negotiation. There's no discussion. If they try to reconstitute their air defenses, then Israel will take it out. If they try to reconstitute their nuclear program, Israel will take it out. And if we need to come back in and do it again, Operation Midnight Hammer 2 is ready to go anytime.
No, I hear you. So Karen Elliott House from The Wall Street Journal has a new book out on MBS. And in it, she just finished it. It's out this week. She said MBS realizes he's got to make friends in the region with Iran because it doesn't seem as though America is now too timid to take action on their nuclear program. And I'm thinking to myself, wrong. Wrong. Because that's fine. But wrong.
Did they go to the printer before
yes.
Operation Midnight Hammer?
Right. So if you're MBS, he goes, I don't have to make friends with my sworn enemy that's already rocketed me for no reason, right? That is already challenging me everywhere across the region. That caused all this unrest that stopped his progress. So even Trump changed in real time how the Middle East views us. And I just thought that was so telling because I'm going to interview her for Sunday show, your favorite show, One Nation, on Sunday at 10 o'clock. I know you like that, and you also like any reality show that has housewives. So those two are your favorite shows, Mark. So, and it's a great book on MBS, but this is how it changes in the region.
Yeah, I'm sure it's true. And this was the result of the Biden policy, right? That we were pushing them into Rap Rushmore with Iran and kind of come to that. And Trump in one night restored deterrence, reset the Middle East. I predict now you're going to see a wave of new Abraham Accords because the bulwark against Iran is Israel, right? Backed by the United States. And by the way, this was a perfect like Reagan doctrine approach to things, because what you do, Israel bore the brunt of the burden of dealing with the threat, and then we came in with an exquisite capability to finish the job. And that's a perfect division of labor. And so that's the division of labor going forward. Israel is going to keep its boot on Iran's neck. And we're there to back them up. We're going to provide them with weapons and intelligence and support. And if we need to come in and deliver a coup de grace, you know, with this capability that we have that no one else does, then we'll do it. And everybody's going to make peace with Israel because Israel is doing the job for the entire Middle East.
And there could be some type of ceasefire. Could be today or by Sunday. And we'll see. Gets at least 10 hostages out. Then you got to decide what 10. Which is going to be a really tough decision, but hopefully it's a decision we get a chance to help make. Mark Thiessen, always great. Read his column in the Washington Post. Appreciate it, Mark.
Thank you, Brian.
All right, back in a moment with you guys.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I'm Janice Dean. Join me every Sunday as I focus on stories of hope and people who are truly rays of sunshine in their community and across the world.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
So a few months ago, I decided I was going to make my first real estate purchase, which is so exciting, and I was going to get an apartment in New York City. But the gag was, it was Babe Ruth's apartment. So naturally, like, I'm telling everybody, I'm excited. I was going to buy it, and I was going to pay with cash. Like, I wanted this apartment bad. Like, it got to the point where the realtor was so confident. Paul and I went, I got an interior designer because I didn't want to bring my college furniture to Babe Ruth's apartment. That would be like criminal. Then the week that I'm supposed to get my keys to my brand new apartment, I get a call. The co-op board denied me.
So that is a little crazy.
So that was Livy Dunn, Brian. She was talking about how a co-op board in New York City denied her. We don't know why.
But why?
They don't know why. They... She's like, it's probably not because of the financials, but it could be because they didn't maybe want like an influencer, you know, a creator in the apartment. It might create some unwanted attention there. Who knows? That's right, part of the co-op board in New York City, right? If you're getting a co-op, they can deny you. You don't need to know why.
I guess that's the situation. I know we have an anchor who we both know very well got turned down because she works at Fox.
And they gave her the reason?
They basically said that. And we don't, you know, we don't think, it's not us. We don't think everybody else in the building really would want you here. How about that? Is that crazy?
Just like Livy Dunn.
It's the Will Cain Show. Watch it live at noon Eastern, Monday through Thursday on FoxNews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss a show. Get the podcast 5 days a week at FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi everyone, I'm Brian Kilmeade. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here on this Thursday, middle of the summer, but in the Trump world, nothing slows down. Whether you like the news or not, he keeps it going. And what I think is most intriguing, that I think he's holding other presidents to a standard, he'll tell you about it. I mean, I can't get enough of putting the cameras in the cabinet room. You know who probably doesn't love it? The cabinet. But he wants the questions in front of everybody. And he wants to see how his cabinet does in front of everybody, meaning the press, who he derides but shows respect by letting them talk to him sometimes four times a day. So before we get to the great Karl Rove, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
It's clear to us as House Democrats, it's clear to us as members of the New York city delegation, that the problem is Donald Trump and House Republicans who have launched this unprecedented assault on the American way of life.
Really, Keem Jeffries, it is really the problem of House Republicans? That's how you answer what's with the Democratic nominee for mayor of New York City, Zohran Mamdani, a major Democratic headache as the Dem nominee for mayor reinforces his radical views, his past comments worse than even his present, and his disciples are beginning to target other Dems like Hakeem Jeffries, David Hogg style.
Number two.
I know they made the request. We're going to have to take a look at it. It's very expensive. It's a shame that we have to spend so much money on a war that would have never happened if I were president.
Ukraine and Gaza coming to a head as Trump seems about to dump Putin and use weapons of our use and get them into the hands of Zelensky. He has specific requests, and it looks like we're ready to answer them. Meanwhile, Congress can step up with massive sanctions, and I think the president is ready to sign off on. And guess what, Vladimir Putin? It's all on you and your inability to see the off-ramp Trump was taking great political risk to give you. On the Hamas and IDF side, it looks like we could have a truce within 48 hours that could last 60 days. I'll talk about it.
Number one.
We are normalizing a government agency disappearing people. We are normalizing. We're talking about it like it's no big deal that they are kidnapping people and transporting them to concentration camps, both domestic and foreign.
Yes, Tiffany Cross must be a fictional writer because she's describing something that's not happening. ICE under attack from within. Yes, blue American cities, radical mayors, left-wing whack jobs, and all Dems can say is drop the mask and stop picking up illegal immigrants and do everything we can to do everything, including try to kill ICE agents. With me right now is Karl Rove, the former deputy chief of staff and senior advisor to George W. Bush, and he's Fox News contributor. Karl, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Carl, I guess the headline, though, around the country has been what's happened in Texas and with the, and still looking for over 100 people that lost their lives. Have you put this in context? Does it remind you of any tragedy that happened before, whether you're in power or not?
Well, no, that's look, this is personal to anybody who, you know, to a lot of people in Central Texas. My wife went to Mystic. Her mother went to Mystic. We have friends and neighbors whose children went to Mystic, and some friends and neighbors whose children were at Mystic on that horrible weekend. And, you know, you drive through my neighborhood, and there are lots of green ribbons, and there's also going to be a lot of broken hearts and grief-stricken parents and families in this town and across Texas. I don't know if you know it, but my boy grew up swimming on the Guadalupe River every summer, about a mile and a half from Mystic. And I had two little houses down there, and my wife and son would decamp in June, and I'd go down on weekends. And I ended up owning a bed and breakfast. It's a complicated story, but I got a picture from a friend of mine, a satellite photograph, and it looks like the little River Oaks Lodge that was where my boy had a wonderful summers as growing up. It's gone. And you know, we don't know how many people. There are going to be people, they tell me, that we only know that they're missing because they failed to show up at work in Houston on Monday, and somebody checked and the family had driven up and parked in an RV park in on the Guadalupe River to celebrate the 4th of July.
So it's just incalculable, the tragedy, and then they're going to look at, you know, what part of it would have been preventable. Talking about something you wrote about this week, we caught up in July 4th and hitting that deadline. Also, a lot of people on vacation weren't paying attention to what the big, beautiful bill is. You listen to an interview with Senator Tillis, and he thinks it's going to be as bad as Obamacare on Barack Obama, where he lost 60-plus seats and that shellacking at the midterms. And it's important, as you write, to tell people what's in this bill, or else somebody else will. Your thoughts?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were going to play some tape. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, my column was, I mean, look, there's a tendency when you pass a big bill like this to have a momentary celebration. We did it. We got it done. And let's move on to the next thing. But the Republicans have got to get engaged on this bill. And the president needs to drive that messaging. And he can't do it in the not normal style that he's inclined to do it. It's a beautiful bill. It's a magnificent, one big, beautiful bill. It's, you know, blah, blah, glorious, never done it before. No. We got to explain this thing, because the Democrats are going to be coming hard at this. There are six polls leading into the passage of the bill. Every single one of them had this bill upside down because the Democrats had framed it as, this is affecting people's health care, and you're taking away health care. And the Republicans have got to get up and say things like, you know, what we're doing is we're saying if you're the people whom they anticipate not having health care are the able-bodied who refuse to work. We have passed a measure in here saying we will help you if you're able-bodied, but you got to be looking for work or working in order to get this benefit. And if the Democrats want to defend having somebody say, you know what, I'm not working, I don't care to work, but I want something free from the government and the taxpayers of America, fine, Democrats defend that. People who are going to lose this coverage are illegal aliens. Now, you and I are both proponents of legal immigration, but we should not be giving something free to people who came here illegally. And let the Democrats defend that. And the other people who are going to be losing coverage are people whom the states are going to identify as not meeting the requirements of the law. We have inappropriate people on the rolls.
Yep.
There's an agreement that there are a large number of them, that it's very, very costly. And for reasons that are simply beyond me, the Biden administration said, we're going to limit the ability of the states to look at their rolls and find people who are ineligible and move them off. Now, why they did that is beyond me. Maybe they really want everybody in America to be on the government tab for health care. But this bill will allow the states to get in and as often as they like, examine the rolls to find people who are receiving inappropriate payments. And that's going to naturally lead to some people who don't deserve, under the laws we have on our books, from receiving Medicaid assistance. So the Republicans have got to go on the offense. They cannot avoid this issue. The Democrats are going to make it the heart and soul of their 2026 midterm election appeal. And if the Republicans do not engage and do not try and put the right. Democrats on the back heel by saying, you defend giving free health care to illegals and people who refuse to work and taking money out of the mouths of the truly vulnerable by having people on the rolls who are inappropriately there.
Right. So he's
got to go on the offense.
And you had to say what you're doing for defense, what you're doing for border security. It's unprecedented.
Right, right.
But you break down, too, and you always go to great research. You look at Quinnipiac, YouGov, some of the major polls, and you point out that they're underwater. But you also said, okay, let me find out what they think about individual elements of this.
Right.
So the Kaiser poll said 68% of respondents support a work requirement. 68. 52% support a work requirement for able and childless adults, with only 33% opposed. Pew Research, 42% support extending the 2017 Trump's tax cuts. 25% oppose it. 49% support extending the tax cuts, while 26% are opposed to it, according to an Ipsos poll. And then 72% yeah. back a Medicaid work requirement, 68% are for requiring states to better screen enrollees. So go ahead and point out where this works, or else people right. like Larry Summers will decide what, if this bill is good. As I'm looking at his column, the former Treasury Secretary under Obama, and it's a wheelchair on the cover. And he writes about how many people are going to die in rural hospitals because they are all going to fold up and everyone in a farm is going to die. And this is about the worst thing that could ever have passed. And, okay, do you have an answer to that? Because Larry Summers comes with credibility. And if you feel as though that's not the case, which every Republican feels that way, maybe except Senator Murkowski, go ahead and go to bat, because that extremist yeah. attitude will do exactly what you mentioned in your column.
Yeah. Now, we won't know how this all plays out by the 2026 election, because some of these provisions kick in 2026 and 2027 and 2028. But, for example, on that one specific point, and that's a great vulnerability, because there is concern. You talk to some of these rural Republicans and they're worried about what's going to happen to their rural hospital if the monies are not there for the hospital. But the answer to that is Republicans have put together a fund of $50 billion that will help keep yeah. rural hospitals in place and going. But look, here's the deal. You have to talk about it. You can't escape it. And you're absolutely right. This is, to me, this is sort of odd. If this is about the one big beautiful bill, it's a loser for Republicans. If it is about the specific elements that make up the one big beautiful bill, we extended the tax cuts. We're saying having a work requirement for people who are able-bodied on Medicaid. We are going to go out of our way to make certain that people who are getting money from Medicaid inappropriately are caught and stopped. We are going to cut off free health care under Medicaid for illegal aliens. Those are winners for Republicans, as are a number of other provisions in the bill. But there has to be a plan. There has to be a commitment to explaining this over the course of the next year and a half. And the president's voice has got to be in this. And the one point that I made in the article that I feel very strongly about is the Republicans cannot go out there and make the mistake that Biden made. Remember, Bidenomics is working. We've solved all the problems. It's Bidenomics is working. Nobody believed it. So the Republicans have got to recognize that what they yeah. got to say to the American people is, we're in a tough place. It's going to take us time to get out, but we're on the right track, it was a big problem, and it takes a big solution. It took time for us. It took 4 years for us to get in this pickle. It's going to take us a couple of years to get out, but we are making the right moves, the tough moves that are necessary to put America in a better place. Don't go out there though and say it's grandiose and we've solved the problem, and it's people tell me that they've never seen a bill as good as this one. People want to see the results, and we've got to lower the expectations, under promise and over deliver.
I hear you. And the other thing I want to just ask you is, I think you're heartened by the president's change of heart when it comes to Ukraine.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, and who helped him change his mind? Vladimir Putin. President Trump has given Vladimir Putin every opportunity to wind this thing up, but it is clear he has one goal in mind, which is the end of Ukraine and its reabsorption into the new Soviet Union, into the Soviet Empire run by Vladimir Putin. I don't know whether he's the leader of the of Russia as the president, or if he sees himself as the new czar. But he ran out his welcome with President Trump, and now we got to back it up. And there are tough moments coming. Yes, the president's turned back on the spigot, and we're going to be sending him military assistance. But remember, that military assistance was approved by the Congress and signed by the president when Joe Biden was in the White House and somebody had control of the auto pen. Now the question is will the Republicans muscle up and do what the Europeans are doing, and that is renewing the military support for Ukraine when this tranche runs out?
I hear you. Right now, when you're looking at, if you would, someone said to you, Carl, I need you to help me. I'm going to Las Vegas. I'm going to bet on who's going to be in control in the House in 2026. Who should I put my money on, Republicans or Democrats? Where should the Karl Rove money go?
If you look at history, you'd have to bet Democrats. Because, you know, that's the way second midterm elections go. There have only been, in the modern era, two midterm elections, one of them a first midterm and one a second midterm election, in which the White House picked up seats. 1998, Democrat Bill Clinton, Democrats picked up seats in the House because Republicans were seen as overreaching on the question of Clinton's relationship with Monica Lewinsky. And in 2002, the Republicans picked up seats in the House. I happen to be in the White House and know a little bit about it. The president had approval ratings in the 60s, and even then it was not easy to get done. It was hard. But having said that, the board next year is going to be very limited. There are like 13 seats that are held by Republicans that Kamala Harris won, and there are like three seats held by Democrats that Donald Trump carried. That's a relatively small number of seats. It is going to be trench warfare. It's World War One. It's going to be won by inches. And either way, the Republicans are either going to maintain control of the House narrowly or the Democrats are going to take it narrowly. If I had to bet, I'd say the Democrats, simply because that's the way history goes. But it is all going to be determined by the quality of the candidates, the quality of the campaign, and the quality of President Trump's messaging. He needs to be focused on explaining to the American people what he is doing and how it's going to help them, and showing compassion for the people who are going to be affected by this or are worried about this.
Right.
If history is a guide, we know how it's going to end. But if the Republicans run a strong campaign with strong candidates and the president provides the necessary leadership, it could be the third election in modern times in which the midterms turned out well.
Right. Some say that the best thing for the Democrats would be for Trump to win so they could stop running against him and fully turn the page rather than spend 2 years investigating him. But that's what sometimes a loss would be a win. That's a theory. Karl Rove, always great to talk to you. Thanks for doing a great column, great research in The Wall Street Journal.
All right, buddy. Thanks for having me on.
You got it. Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
It's Will Tank Country. Watch it live at noon Eastern Monday through Thursday at foxnews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss the show. Listen and follow the podcast 5 days a week at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
It is exactly what the movie is about, I think, that, like, we support our people, you know? We love our immigrants. We love, yes, Superman is an immigrant. And, yes, the people that we support in this country are immigrants. And if you don't like that, then you're not American.
So if I don't like, Allison, help me make sense of this. If I don't like Superman, or if I don't agree that he is a immigrant, because he comes from another planet, but in fairness to him, the planet did explode.
Sure. And then he'd be an alien though, right? Not an immigrant.
Right. Yes. I mean, he would have special status, kind of like Venezuela, communists. And if your planet explodes, you would probably get TPS, temporary protective status. But calling him an immigrant is such an interesting way to sell what turns out to be a bad movie that nobody wants to see. Do you think that is a good marketing angle?
It is not. Apparently, they tried to walk it back. I've heard different things, that it is a good movie. I don't know. I've yet to see it. I have. I saw, oh my gosh, Lois Lane, Rachel. She was in The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel doing an interview this morning. But she's, I think, just great. So I think, I'm curious to see it. So I can't say it's a bad movie till I see it.
Well, could you say that if you were marketing the movie, you'd be happy or unhappy with that statement?
Oh, it's a terrible statement.
It's a terrible statement. It sounds like you were soft-pedaling it and making excuses for it.
No, terrible statement. They walked that back.
So we agree on that. But Superman, we're glad we have him. I wish we really had a Superman. It would, because Ice needs some help.
You could dress up like Superman.
Thinking about it.
This is Jimmy Failla, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.
Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
No, I mean, anybody. It could happen to anybody. I mean, everybody, especially if you're a public figure, they just got to get enough. Like, they could take the interview out of here today and change it around. So, but, you know, as soon as I found out about it last week, I referred it to the FBI, diplomatic security, and others. It won't be the last time you see me or others, for that matter. Maybe some of you will be impersonated. But it's just a reality of this AI technology that's going on, and it's a real threat.
That, of course, is Secretary of State Marco Rubio. What he was referring to is that he was impersonated, and it wasn't easy to detect, and they recognized it quickly, and they acted on it. But we've seen a lot of stuff, not nearly as important as the Secretary of State who said foreign policy being impersonated, but we've seen it with Fox anchors. They have me doing stuff I wasn't doing. It looks absolutely legitimate. And this really only happened really over the last 2 months. I mean, they have stuff about Ainsley and Sean that's up every morning. We look up and we see some other crazy story that looks, and they have pictures, but they never, neither one of them were ever there. Teresa Payton joins us now, former White House Chief Information Officer from during the Bush years, cybersecurity authority and identity theft expert, CEO and founder of Fortalice Solutions. Teresa, welcome back. Your take, and you wrote about this in the Washington Post, about this impersonation, just the tip of the iceberg on the danger that's out there.
Yeah, Brian, it's great to be with you. And you and I have been talking about this, actually, that this day was going to come. We've been talking about this for years. And, you know, President Reagan always would say, trust but verify. We've entered into an age now, Brian, where it's never trust and always verify. And, you know, candidly, there needs to be protections and guardrails around this technology. So, for example, if you use deepfake technology to edit or create a video, those software companies should be required to watermark that audio or watermark the video to say this has been generated using this platform. So there's some different things that we could be doing that we're not doing, we should be doing, and here we are. So kudos to Marco Rubio for going public, for reporting it, so now an investigation can happen.
Why is AI so much harder, and it's coming so quickly? So really, 3 years, 4 years? And what are we staying up with it? Are we staying up with their defense?
Well, no. And you know, right now, the way I would classify things in sort of this hype cycle of the technology is there is a prioritization, it seems, of profit over people. Because if we put people first, as we thought about this technology, we would say, what are all the great things that it can enable for us? And then how are all the ways it could be misused? And how do we create guardrails around that? But because it's right now looks like profit over people, we don't have things like we have in cars today. You know, you don't make a car without brakes. You, I mean, unless it's a race car or maybe, you know, a Boy Scout project, but you don't make cars without brakes. They have seatbelts, they have airbags, they have backup cameras, they have alarms. We need to do the same thing for technology. Otherwise, we're going to end up exactly with what happened to Marco Rubio. Thankfully, it sounds like none of our foreign officials that were contacted by the operatives and none of the
using
domestic
his voice
fell
yeah
for it. Yes.
Yeah, and using his voice, and they could have done anything. They could say, hey, we're bombing this, or we could taking this out, or Donald Trump has decided X, Y, and Z, and it sounds exactly like him, and there's nothing you could do about it. They say that we have adapted to AI quicker than we adapted to the internet, and more people have caught up and gotten involved with this technology than anyone that got involved online, and we thought that was quick in the 90s. Do you find the same thing? And why do you think that is, that we were so open to jumping into this?
Well, we're in a post-pandemic world. Almost everybody has a mobile phone in their pocket. In the 90s with the internet, you had to sit at a computer. You had to download a browser. You had to kind of find your way around. Now it's just a simple app. Most of these apps are free. And in a post-pandemic world where for a time being, things were locked down and we were driven to do everything online, it's considered more acceptable. But, you know, it's interesting. So there's, if people are feeling like this is all over the place, it is. So study, Brian, came out that said there's been a 3,000% surge, not in your and my 401k, but in global deepfake phishing incidents that have been reported. Those are the ones who have been reported. And the majority of these deepfake phishing incidents are truly AI-driven by the cyber criminal syndicates and the nation states.
So everyone's got to be aware of this. And it's a way of, you know, remember we used to get that email from that Nigerian prince who said that he has money and he's got to move it and we should give him our accounts or give him money and an investment. And we used to laugh at that. But now it's so much more sophisticated. A lot of smart people get lured in.
A lot of smart people get lured in. And I'm actually, besides this kind of incident here with Marco Rubio, we're also seeing elder fraud abuse crimes skyrocket. So we're seeing where we have people being approached with impersonator accounts. Impersonator accounts are all over. All of the social media platforms are all guilty of not doing enough to take down imposter accounts of all notable figures, whether it's Marco Rubio or Pope Leo. And then these imposter accounts are reaching out to people, duping them into thinking using deepfake voice cloning, deepfake video cloning, that they are actually communicating in some cases real time with Pope Leo or, you know, with Alex from Halo or with a Marco Rubio. And then they're being directed to do cryptocurrency schemes, wire money for, quote, a charity. And it's, yeah, it's really sort of very distressing.
Yeah. So, yeah. This person pretending to be Marco Rubio or this AI image, Rubio, called three different states, three different countries. But then you have Susie Wiles, who's also somebody that seems to have been hacked or impersonated.
Yes, exactly, because we don't know all the details, and we may never know, which is fine, around how did somebody get access to her contacts to be able to actually pretend to be Susie, but also know who her contacts were versus sort of just randomly reaching out to people. So that is problematic as well. And you know, what's interesting. So there are some different tools out there that people can use to try to prevent things from happening while we're waiting for big tech to figure things out, or either be told there's going to be some regulation where you have to figure things out so that people can be safer. So there are a few things out there. They're not super easy to use yet, but there's tools like McAfee actually has something called a deep fake detector, which can look at video and audio in real time and tell you like, huh, there's a few strange things here. There's some really interesting technology coming out called liveness detection or proof of life detection that financial services companies are looking at using. And, you know, still I always tell people, follow your gut instincts. So, you know, is Marco Rubio reaching out to you on Signal or Susie Wiles? Think about that. Never trust. Always verify. You can always call the White House operator and say, hey, I'm getting messages from, you know, this person. Is that really legitimate? And talk to the White House operator about it.
Yeah. The other thing is, you got to look out for Iran. They want some redemption in terms of hackers. North Korea, Iran, Russia, are they still the top?
They are still the top as far as nation states who are targeting individuals. So you have China, who's very concerned about the trade war. So China will be doing this. Iran, Russia, North Korea has not been as active in the social engineering, but that doesn't mean don't count them out. They just might be distracted and focused on other things. But then the cyber criminal syndicates have taken a page out of the nation state book and say, well, if somebody can pretend to be Marco Rubio, then I can pretend to be this notable figure and try to get access to their cryptocurrency or get access to their financials. And, you know, try to pretend to be a CFO asking for a wire transfer to happen, for example. So really, it's the nation states, but the cyber criminal syndicates tend to be copying those tactics and using it for fraud.
Yeah, I guess we should all look out for that. So we had this big story at X, and they turns out they have Grok as their AI. And maybe it's reflective of the people on there. But evidently, when asked about certain questions about who could have fixed Texas or who could have anticipated that overflowing of the river that tragically took so many lives and still more to come, the word is Hitler. Hitler could have handled it. And they start praising Nazis. And Grok has basically been taken offline. They're trying to fix it. So is AI crowdsourcing? Are we getting information of just what other people think?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked this question, Brian. So I look at AI and I like to have people think about it as sort of like layers of a cake, right? So at the bottom layer of the cake, you have these engineers that you do not know. And these engineers walk around with conscious and unconscious biases. So they're creating things, and engineers are fallible people. They make mistakes. And those biases play out, like facial recognition technology doesn't do a good job identifying a name and faces of, you know, people of color. They can't even discern gender. So you have to look back and say, why is that? Well, many of the engineers that worked on the early days of facial recognition were whites and Asians. And so it wasn't a conscious bias. It was an unconscious bias because the test pool was other engineers sitting in the cubicle. Fast forward to the next layer of the cake. You then have the internet as a dumpster fire, and the internet also has great information. If you have generative AI tools who are being trained on screen scraping the internet and getting information on the internet, it's not going to be a lovely, curated, beautiful koi pond, which has, you know, Zen and Feng Shui. It's going to be a combination of that beautiful koi pond that's been curated and the dumpster fire that is the internet. And then the last layer of the cake is, who's doing the data tagging to give you that information in real time? And a lot of times the data people doing the data tagging are not data scientists. They're people paid below minimum wage. They're sitting in an operation center and they're just doing the best they can, and they're getting paid by the number of data tags that they do. So that's the three layers of the cake that make up the answers that we're getting.
It's amazing. And everything's changing so quick too. Thanks so much. Appreciate it. Teresa Payton, appreciate what you're doing.
Brian, I always love to be with you. Have me back anytime. You're an awesome media news pro.
Thanks. And we definitely need to find out what's next, because there's a lot of people out to get us individually and our country. Teresa Payton, thanks. When we come back, we'll finish up with phone calls, 1-866-408-7669, or write me, Brian Kilmeade. Go to BrianKilmeade.com and click on comments. That's also a place where you can get tickets August 23rd and September 27th. August 23rd in Dallas, Texas. September 27th, Richmond, Virginia. See you then.
Increasing your intelligence quotient.
What the hell did you just say?
It's Brian Kilmeade.
It is time to take the quiz.
It's five questions in less than 5 minutes. We ask people on the streets of New York City to play along. Let's see how you do.
Take the quiz every day at thequiz.fox. Then come back here to see how you did.
Thank you for taking the quiz.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
But did you have concerns about the president's health and his mental acuity
no.
at all? None.
No. Whatsoever. I had none. Now, granted, I didn't see Joe Biden every single day, but I did have an opportunity to interact with the president. I never had a concern. He may get fumbled up by words, but that's not anything new, and it's not anything that came with age. We know that this is someone that was born with a stutter that ultimately had to get over it.
She is such a clown. Congresswoman Crockett can't even read the real room. She's reading the room from 7 years ago when she was running against, when he was running against President Trump, or 5 years ago. Oh, you're making fun of a stutter. Did you read Jay Tapper's book? He apologized for going after Laura Trump for saying that same thing. Crockett, it just keeps on giving for her. She thinks she's a superstar, and maybe to the ultra left wing she is, but she hurts her party every time she speaks. And why? Well, she asked that question because oversight hearings are trying to find out what Joe Biden was doing and not doing as president. And if mentally he was not there, we witnessed it beyond the debate. The first time Democrats admitted it was at the debate and afterwards. His doctor wouldn't talk. I won't play all of it, but Kevin O'Connor, who says never give him a mental test, never give him a prostate test. He's got prostate cancer and he's mentally deficient. What kind of doctor is this clown? Cut 21.
I must respectfully decline to answer based upon physician-patient privilege and in the reliance on my right under the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution.
Did you ever believe the president was unfit to execute his duties as president?
I must respectfully decline to answer based on the physician-patient privilege and in reliance on my right under the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution. I'm not a lawyer, and I must follow my lawyer's advice in this matter.
Right, to your doctor. Now, look, everyone's entitled to take the Fifth, but you can conclude what you're going to conclude. If you're proud of what you did and proud of how you served, like, let's say, the previous doctor there who was under a lot of fire, but was proud of how he took care of Bush, Obama, and Trump, and now he's a congressman from Texas. Why is he proud of it? Because he has nothing to hide from. Now, if Kevin O'Connor felt as though he gave him top-flight care and that he was mentally efficient and should have been president, why didn't he use that opportunity to say it and defend it? Instead, he takes the Fifth on what advice? Maybe we got some clues last night. Listen to James Comer with Jesse. James Comer is conducting the oversight. Cut 24.
Well, we're going to try to get every bit of information we have. What we're finding in the Biden administration is they didn't leave very many records behind when they walked out that door. There are so many instances of documents that we've been waiting to request. And now the Trump administration's in office and they can't find the records. But we're going to try to get those medical records. We're going to try to do everything we can. We're going to use every tool that we have to try to get that information. But we're going to proceed with this investigation. And we're moving very rapidly Good. For a congressional investigation. Good. We have 9 more interviews and depositions set up. And I think we'll get some clear answers as to who authorized the use of the AutoPen and whether or not Joe Biden was mentally
Congressman,
fit.
Congressman, are you suggesting that perhaps that the doctor or Biden aides absconded with documents or destroyed documents?
Well, I mean, well, we've seen a pattern in the Biden administration where they didn't leave very many documents behind.
Yes, they stuck him in a closet and they were discovered to be top secret documents. And then they went to his house and they found documents dating back to when Helmut Kohl was running West Germany. And he held on to all of it and was proud of it. Remember those documents cases when he would have been prosecuted if he wasn't an elderly man with a bad memory? Yeah, this is unbelievable. And now they got a new book out just talking about how bad he was. But they talk more about the strategy behind Joe Biden, about him taking the debate early, about what was going on behind the scenes, how few people had any faith in Kamala Harris. And I think it's important to bring that up. In terms of Harris, listen to this just emerged from a podcast that didn't air because she was so confused and so her statements were so ridiculous. Her team asked to take it down and not air it. Cut 26. This is Karina Rama of the Subway Takes. She's Subway Takes host. He's the Subway Takes host.
Her take was really confusing and weird and not good. And so mutually agreed that we shouldn't publish it.
I see.
And I got lucky because I didn't want to be blamed for her losing.
Her take was that bad?
It was really, really bad. And it was like didn't make any sense. I can tell you. Bacon as a spice. Bacon as a spice.
So this guy's a comedian. Evidently it's a popular podcast. But he said that she was just out of it. And the team called him up and said, please take it down. He said, all right, that's fine. Don't end up like The View. Brian Kilmeade Show.
This is Jason Chaffetz from the Jason in the House podcast. Join me every Monday to dive deeper into the latest political headlines and chat with remarkable guests.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com
or wherever you download podcasts.